Hello world, my name is David Malin, and these are CS50's office hours, so to speak. Traditionally on campus at a place like Harvard, office hours are these opportunities for students to visit professors' offices or teaching assistants' offices and ask them questions about the course, ask them questions about homework assignments and the like. For us, CS50, with so many students around the world online, we thought we'd use these office hours, as we have in weeks past, to just be an opportunity to ask questions about computer science, about CS50, about college, about Massachusetts, really anything of interest. But if it's specific to homework assignments, best to ask those questions online, because all we have here are our cell phones and can't really see questions related to code. So we're here indeed outside of Harvard University and outside of the biological laboratory. So this is where all the science students on campus spend a lot of time. I myself only took biology in ninth grade, so it's been quite a while, but this is actually one of my favorite parts of campus. There's just a beauty back here. It's nice and quiet and tranquil. I mean, I'm literally standing on a volleyball court that the students can use out here. And it's especially ornate on the building. In fact, if we walk over here, you can see along the top of the bio labs is all of these carvings of various animals and the names thereof, and that spans the entire building, which is several stories tall. And fun fact, back when I was a freshman, like way back when in university, I actually explored this part of campus, I still remember, and I somehow got into the building, went to the top floor, where there's this beautiful greenhouse where they were doing lots of growing of things, experiments and the like. So even now, all these years later, I have really fond memories of that. I'm gonna be joined in just a bit by my teammate, CS50's own Carter Zenke, with whom I've just been playing some volleyball on this very here court. Now, that's not actually true. We're just kind of pretending, and Carter didn't even throw me that ball. And in fact, this isn't even a volleyball, it's a soccer ball, but we thought this'd be a nice bridge via which we can now take a stroll over here and introduce Carter, who's kindly been awaiting us playing here.
Oh, hey, David,
on
nice
the court.
Catch.
Nice to see you, Carter. It's a great match before.
Yeah.
Well, so I was just reminiscing with everyone about my favorite part of campus this year, the bio labs, and got me thinking about biology, which I myself didn't take since like ninth grade, so that was quite a bit of time ago. How much science did you ever study?
I think I did some biology, like maybe in ninth grade. Did some chemistry too.
Okay, yeah, me too.
And then I did some physics, which I actually really enjoyed a lot.
I did like physics. It was very physical. And actually, I actually think about my physics class a lot when we try to come up with new ideas for CS50 and doing things on stage. We haven't quite ever done anything with explosions, but I do have such fond memories of high school and even in college or maybe grad school where I audited a physics class with Professor David Morin here at Harvard, who taught physics 15A at the time. And it was just like every week was a different demonstration. I remember he was like lying on a bed of nails to demonstrate, I think, how you can distribute force by just having a very large surface area, so it didn't actually hurt, even though of course it looked a bit scary.
Yeah, I had a teacher named Mr. Price in high school who did the very same thing. I think he stood on like a bed of nails, and we were all super shocked when he like didn't get pierced through with all
the nails, so. And I feel like I see on Instagram and the like all the time these physics professors now who have like a really big cannonball or something really heavy on a rope, and they let go of it and it swings away from them, but they stay very still and it doesn't actually hit them in the face because of conservation of energy? I don't remember my physics either.
I think you're right there.
Okay, something like that. Google that later, folks. We should probably focus more on computer science, which Carter and I are more expert in. If you'd like to ask us some questions via the chat, please do. Again, on CS50, computer science, university, or life more generally. Have any questions been coming in?
Yeah, I think a related one here, we have a question from Siraj, who's a chemical engineering major at the University of Illinois.
Okay, that escalated quickly. Okay.
They're asking, should they perhaps minor in CS? Or what do you think is the usefulness of CS for something like chemistry?
Oh, that's interesting. So I majored in CS, which meant I took like 12 or more courses and then also went on to graduate school. But to minor in computer science, if unfamiliar, means to take fewer courses. So it depends on the university, but it might be 4 courses in computer science, maybe 6 courses, give or take. It probably varies by school. But it's an opportunity to go beyond your own primary interest, your so-called major, and study something that's secondarily of interest, like computer science. I think if it's of interest, absolutely. Like if you can fit it into your schedule, if you can do it without it being to the detriment of your other studies or activities, like I think that's super compelling. Those fields, chemical engineering and computer science, are probably intersectional in the sense that they're both part of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. So I mention this because I would generally typically encourage students to consider like a minor in computer science if they're majoring in something very different for which there aren't already opportunities to take classes in CS or in computing more generally. For instance, if you're majoring in the arts, the humanities, the social sciences, I think minoring in something like CS just gives you all the more of a mental model for other ways to solve problems and other skills like actual practical programming skills. So in short, I see no reason not to minor in computer science, but I would especially encourage it if your field of study is not itself already STEM.
Yeah, I had a friend in college who was focused on chemistry and on drug discovery, how we could try to prevent things like cancer. And he actually did a lot with computer science, trying to help discover new drugs kind of programmatically. So it was very interesting to me to learn from
interesting.
Him.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, thanks for the question.
Yeah. Another question here is shifting gears a little bit, but they're asking about AI and asking about their take on how AI can help programmers nowadays. Is in the past we had to use Google, but now it takes less than a minute to use something like ChatGPT. So how could we use these tools to help us?
Yeah, I mean, I think for programmers, it's poised to be a very good productivity boost. Like a buddy of ours, Colton Ogden, who teaches CS50's Introduction to Game Development, he actually attests to having used GitHub Copilot, which is one of the AI-based software tools nowadays for programmers, in such a way that it boosts his productivity, he claims, by like 20-30%. So specifically by just helping him write code faster and help him avoid having to Google things or go to Stack Overflow or read the actual documentation. Even I haven't played with GitHub Copilot or similar tools that much since I don't write that much code, ironically, myself. But when I have, I mean, it certainly has helped me figure out like new APIs or SDKs, software development kits, where the traditional approach would be to go to the official documentation, look at all of the function signatures, look at the return values, figure out what it does and how it works and so forth. And that's fine. And that's like the right way to do it, but it's also very time consuming. And by contrast, nowadays in recent months, if I want to figure out like, how do I make an HTTP GET request using the request library in Python, like totally Googleable, totally lookupable in documentation. But honestly, if I just ask something like ChatGPT or GitHub Copilot and just kind of start my thought or ask the question, boom, I have the code that I want. So it just saves time, and I'm finding that personally as well.
I think I'm impressed by these tools that work within an IDE, like where you actually edit code. Yeah. So you don't have to go outside of it to find some information you're looking for. I find it helps me actually focus and get into a flow state more versus switching between tabs and going between Google and back to my code and vice versa.
Yeah, so. For sure. I think it's a nice evolution of what's been around for a while, like Google and Stack Overflow, but it is indeed putting it all right in situ for you, like in the place that you're at using VS Code or some similar tool, and it speeds things up. And that said, I would say that I would avoid, especially if you're learning programming for the first time, via CS50 or some other class or experience, like to avoid the temptation to overly rely on these tools too soon, because honestly, if GitHub Copilot or similar tools are sort of auto-completing a lot of the code you're writing and you don't actually understand it, like you're not doing yourself a good service there. I mean, one, the code could be wrong, even though I do think longer term that will be less and less of a concern probabilistically, but two, like you should have ownership, I think, intellectually and in terms of responsibility for what it is you're creating. And frankly, you can think of it as a teacher, like it's helping you more quickly pick up some new skills, but I think you should still take those moments to like actually understand or even ask something like ChatGPT, how does that work or what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, switching gears a little bit to another question here, we have a question from, don't have the name quite here, but they're asking about, have you thought about having an in-person conference for CS50 or something that kind of brings folks to campus in any way?
It's a good question. And we've thought about this for some time and talked about it a lot internally, particularly before COVID, and then COVID kind of put that vision on hold. Carter and I should probably talk about that again because it has been of interest to bring like CS50X students and teachers to campus, perhaps for a series of talks or workshops or the like. We do already for teachers specifically host an annual workshop in the summer to which we do bring teachers from around the world, but that's a smaller group and it indeed is folks who are already typically teachers themselves. But we've also thought about generalizing it away from CS50. I've always found it inspiring to sit in on other professors, other teachers' classes. I still think back fondly on David Morin's class in physics, which was just so visual and theatrical, which is a word we use a lot to describe CS50 nowadays. And I think it would be great fun to just bring students and teachers alike to sort of delight in like really cool educational ideas and applications, even if it's just like lightning talks or 5 minutes here or there, because I think we can all certainly learn from other fields as well. So yeah. Hold that thought. We'll give it some more thought. This is definitely of interest.
Yeah, and in the absence of being able to invite folks to campus, which requires a lot of logistics and flights and travel, like I really enjoyed the online events we've been hosting recently. And I got a question here about Ready Player 50, which is, are we planning to do that again or something similar to that in the future?
That's a good question. For those unfamiliar, Ready Player 50 was this online game written by our friends at Lakera, which is an AI-based company with whom we got friendly over the past few months. And they, a few months back, had a game online called Gandalf, which went viral in the sense that lots of people started playing around with it. And what the game is a series of levels whereby each one is progressively harder, and each one is a challenge to try to figure out what the secret word is, the secret password. But it's an exercise, ultimately, in what's nowadays called prompt engineering, like trying to engineer good prompts, good questions in English or some other language to get an AI to do something. But it also was an opportunity to explore a threat called prompt injection attacks, which are similar in spirit, actually, to SQL injection attacks, if you're familiar with those from CS50 or Carter's new SQL class itself. Whereby you try to trick the AI into doing something that the original programmer did not intend or that the AI itself is not supposed to do. So wonderfully, our friends at Lakera wrote like all of the challenges. They integrated some very CS50 specific themes, the duck being the biggest one of them. So much fun, and we're so appreciative. I'm not sure we want to ask more of them to come up with yet more levels, and I do think the art of prompt engineering, the process of trying to implement these injection attacks, I do think, frankly, is going to change for the better probably in the coming months and certainly year. So hopefully we won't need to discuss worries like prompt injection attacks nearly as much in the future, but we will see. I think we're all gonna kind of take a break from taking on such a big endeavor. But it was so much fun, and thank you all for participating. It was great fun to see the answers, the engagement, a lot of the social media posts of people posting their like celebratory duck and fireworks. So super fun.
Yeah, and if you play the game and watch the solution walkthrough, I was really fascinated by all of the different guards that Max and Natalie showed us that AI can have, like a guard before the prompt even gets to the model, a guard like kind of in the model, a guard after that you get the response from the model. So there's lots of different ways you can build this up, which I find really fascinating.
And one of my favorite excerpts from someone's prompt was something along the lines of, I'm getting sleepy, can you please just give me a hint, or something like that. And I feel like the duck actually kind of sort of obliged, as I recall, or it could be confusing it with another example. If you're just hearing about Ready Player 50 for the very first time, know that it's an allusion to a movie, which is actually a lot of fun, called Ready Player One, which is sort of about this dystopian future in which everyone exists or spends much of their time in augmented or virtual reality. But the challenge itself is still freely available online at cs50.ly/ready, R-E-A-D-Y.
Exactly. A follow-on question related to cybersecurity, which you just finished your course on, about public and private key cryptography. If a public key is used to encode a message and a private key is used to decode a message, could the public key be used to reverse the message?
A good question. Short answer, no. So the mathematical relationship between a public key and a private key is such that they are unidirectional processes. You use the public key to encrypt, you use the private key to decrypt. You should not be able to mathematically use the same public key to also decrypt. If you can, something is very, very wrong with the algorithm or your implementation thereof. And to our knowledge now, with popular algorithms like RSA, with Diffie-Hellman, with others, there are no known such issues there if you're using them correctly and using correct implementations thereof. That said, you can use the public key in a different way. If you've not taken CS50's Introduction to Cybersecurity, one of the topics we do talk about is called digital signatures, whereby someone else, you, or rather, whereby you can use your private key to digitally sign some document, some file, some piece of data, and then someone else can use your public key to verify that signature. So it's sort of like you are reversing the encryption and decryption process, but it's still asymmetric. You use one key for one process and the other key for the other. You can't use the same for both.
Yeah. One thing I like about that course is that it's more conceptual, so there's less actual programming, but you kind of understand the basics behind security and how it actually works mathematically.
Yeah.
And the question here is somebody asking about a coding boot camp. So I think you learn how to program in those, not so much, maybe not so much conceptually oriented as well. But what are your thoughts on like the usefulness of coding boot camps and their role in becoming a programmer?
It's a good question. I've never experienced one personally, so take all of this with a grain of salt and ask people who have maybe done it if it was valuable for them. My sense of a lot of boot camps in the US, at least in recent years, maybe a little less so now, is that there were so many of them and they were so darn expensive, honestly. Like in the US, like thousands of dollars. That said, they're typically very immersive, whereby you spend several days, several weeks, maybe even several months working alongside of others, being mentored by folks more experienced than you. And so I think it depends on, one, the reputation of the bootcamp you're considering, and two, what it is you're actually paying for. Like, probably the most valuable thing to pay for would be like actual human support. So mm-hmm. you'd want there to be some good ratio between the number of paying students and the number of teaching teachers, whether they're the staff or they're teaching assistants or course assistants or however they're called, because I think that's probably the most valuable thing. Like if I were to pay Carter to tutor me essentially, right, that's kind of a similar analog where I'm hopefully getting a lot out of that one-on-one interactions. He knows me, I know him, I can ask him very specific questions instead of just Googling. But if the boot camp is much more hands-off, where you're kind of left on your own, where you aren't very easily able to talk to other humans who are more experienced than you, it's probably not worth paying very much for. I think that's how you should think about the value.
Yeah, and a follow-on question we got here was, you know, do we think it takes 10,000 hours to be a pro at something like programming? And I think my take on that is it's not so much the number of hours, it's like the kinds of practice you get, the kinds of relationships you build. Like, I think it's one thing to learn from a book kind of on your own, but another thing to go out and actually talk with people who are in the field to learn from them in this kind of hands-on environment. And I can help you become a pro, I think, much faster than you're kind of learning on your own in some ways.
Yeah, I do think so. That sounds like a really high number, certainly, and kind of arbitrary. And for what it's worth, like, I learned how to program in a university environment. So I literally took CS50 25 some years ago. Then I took really one other software class called CS51, which is not freely available online, but there are analogs to it online, surely, that teaches us about functional programming, which is a different type of program that we sort of scratched the surface of in CS50, but not very much, and object-oriented programming. And those were really the only two courses in which someone else taught me languages in particular. In fairness, I took one other very software-centric class years later, which was on operating systems, where you essentially build pieces of a Linux-like operating system. But what was valuable about that course was that you work with a partner. So a friend of mine and I, we kind of teamed up, as did other pairs of students. And it was my first opportunity to learn how to collaborate with someone else on code. And you know, it was funny, we got along wonderfully well. It was a perfect sort of marriage in terms of partnership, because he and I would meet at like the beginning of the week. We'd literally go into a classroom with a chalkboard, we'd talk about the APIs, application programming interfaces, that we want to design, and we would then kind of have a to-do list, like, okay, I'm going to go back home for the week and work on these functions, he's going to go back to his room and work on those functions. And then amazingly, all these years later, I'm still amazed we actually got this right. You know, 5+ days later, we'd get back together and he had implemented his code, I had implemented my code, and therefore I could just call his functions, he could call my functions, and we sort of meshed very well. But that was a hugely valuable experience. So it's not just a matter of hours spent, it's not just a matter of getting stuck in like tutorial hell where all you're doing is taking lessons. Like, you really do want to apply it. And so, long story short, I took formally like 3 software classes, and everything else since has been self-taught. I don't think I'm necessarily a great programmer. I feel like I always am embarrassed by code I wrote last year, so hopefully that means I'm just getting better and better. But this is 25 some years in, so that's probably not uncommon for folks to hopefully feel that way too, making progress.
I think it's a very good example of how much of computer science is not just programming, like actually sitting down and talking to somebody else and whiteboarding things and trying to design a system is a very important part of computer science as well.
Yeah. And funny enough, it doesn't even have to be a whiteboard. So Kareem Zidane, whom some of you might remember, is one of our former staff members, took CS50X online from home in Egypt years ago, but then he spent several years with us here in Cambridge. And he and I actually used to be in very good shape, and we would go jogging along the Charles River, which is like a very well-known river and beautiful place to jog and walk and bike here. And we would have some of our most rigorous like design discussions, things for which we didn't necessarily need a whiteboard and visuals, but we could kind of like argue with each other or talk through design possibilities. And at least for me, it was a great way to trick me into exercising, because I'd be so distracted by like the argument he and I are having verbally that I didn't even realize that we already just ran a mile or two along the way. So
yeah, I agree. A comment here, it's kind of related, for somebody who says they feel sometimes scared to collaborate with somebody because they often feel like they don't know as much. Do you have any advice for how to collaborate with people who might know more than you or might be kind of more experienced than you?
Yeah, my gut wants to tell me, like, oh, avoid it. It's too stressful. No, I definitely feel that way with some of my more experienced friends who are like full-time professional software engineers and surely know more than I do. But that said, those are exactly like the friends whom I'm constantly texting or direct messaging when I do have questions. Like, there's this relatively short list of humans, some of them former students who are now in the real world and industry, whom I would happily now reach out to with questions. And honestly, I feel like life's too short to sort of pretend like you know more than you do. You might as well just like show your hand, be like, I have no idea what this means. But like, if you're willing to figure it out, and if you're generally smart enough and experienced enough that you have enough of a mental model to like learn some new feature of this language because you already know this language, I think you should just embrace that and like actually seek out people who are better than you and who do know more than you, because otherwise you're not getting anything out of spending time with people who aren't that way.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think one thing I've tried to do is try to find those places where I can learn from other folks, even though it can feel scary and daunting, and it's really worked out, I think, for my own development and knowledge as well.
Yeah, so. I mean, among CS50's past team members, if some of you online know them, like Tommy McWilliam for years ago, who taught some of CS50's tracks on mobile some time ago, Colton Ogden, formerly of our team, who now works full-time in software development, Brian Yu, who was our former preceptor, did a lot of teaching as well. Those folks are all people whom I keep in. Some of them might be favorites in my phone so that I can text them all the easier.
Yeah. We have a question about a variety of courses that we have. Mm-hmm. Actually, a question on our SQL course, which just came out on October 1st.
Oh, I hear good things.
Yeah.
What an interesting choice you've made in asking this question, Carter.
Yeah, so the question is it easier than something like CS50X, CS50W, and CS50P? And I would say it probably not so much easier as it is just kind of like a different skill set. So in SQL, you learn how to work with databases and data sets, which you can work with a little bit in CS50X, but not as like deeply as I'd say you would in SQL. And one thing I kind of like about SQL is that you're writing the language to do something you want it to do, and it kind of figures out how best to do that for you in the underlying database management system at the end of the day.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
I do think the workload is different. Like CS50X is much more work and therefore is much more rigorous and time consuming. I would probably liken CS50 SQL to like CS50 Python in terms of like accessibility and workload.
Agreed.
But a different type of problem.
Yeah, and the goal is to give you like a variety of data sets to work with that are all inspired by the real world. So you get this kind of variety of practice you can use as you're beginning your journey in SQL.
Yeah. So. Well, I hear good things. You can sign up for free at cs50.edx.org/SQL or SQL.
Yeah.
We did get some hate on the internet for my saying SQL all the time because there's a fan base out there that likes to say SQL.
Oh, really?
Feels like it takes too much time for me.
I feel like the course would be a little bit longer if I said SQL all the time.
Yes. Yes.
For people who've already taken CS50 already, what's one tip you have for them to understand a hard concept, like something like pointers or programming syntax in C or in Python?
Teach it to someone else. Mm. This is like a secret weapon in education. We tell this to our own teaching fellows or teaching assistants when we do training at the start of every semester at Harvard or Yale. I learn, and I do think a lot of people learn so much more when you actually have to teach a topic than when you're just sitting there being taught a topic. And for me, at least, it is because one, I'm now responsible for like others' experience, and so I take even more responsibility, I think, for making sure I do a good job. I think part of it is like embarrassment avoidance, whereby I don't want to be caught too frequently not knowing the answer to some question. Like, it's totally fine not to know the answer sometimes and be like, I'll get back to you tomorrow, let me Google it myself, read up on it, because presumably you have a better ability to find that information, understand and process that information, and then explain it ideally in simpler terms to a newer student. But I do think you want that not to be the common case where you're getting back to people on like 51% of the questions that they've asked. That doesn't feel ideal. So when I prep for classes, including CS50 nowadays, anytime I'm like, wait a minute, like, why is that? I find myself going down these intellectual rabbit holes where I'll Google, I'll go on Wikipedia, I'll ask ChatGPT nowadays, I'll ask CS50's own Glenn Holloway or Rongxin Alu, who are more learned than I in so many areas of code, just to make sure I do understand all of the lower level implementation details. And case in point, in week 4 of CS50, a week ago, if you were watching the live stream, I kind of embarrassed myself because I was trying to get a program called get.c to deliberately crash when induce a seg fault, a memory related error in C. And it was just flailing because I couldn't get the darn code to actually crash, as I could have sworn I did before class, but in retrospect, I must have tested something else instead. And I couldn't quite remember like why it wasn't working this time around. And so I emailed with Rongxin and with Glenn behind the scenes, and Glenn pointed out and gave me some sample code for code that would much more deterministically actually crash. Long story short, what I wasn't realizing is that it would be easier for me to have used not one malloc call, but two back to back so that the memory I'm allocating is adjacent. And then he suggested that I overflow the first buffer by typing in something really long. That would overflow not only part of the memory malloc gave me for the second chunk, but also header information, so metadata that the actual malloc function in the system library is managing for you underneath the hood, kind of tucked away. And then if you try freeing both of those pointers returned by malloc, then you do indeed induce a seg fault. And you can actually see the overflow because whatever you typed into the first buffer actually overlaps the second buffer. So conversation I wish Glenn and I had had before class and not after, but even I, after time, sort of forget certain details or forget what it did, what it was I did last year that worked really well. And so I mess up too. So
yeah, it seems like a creative solution to me. I'm wondering how you think Glenn knew to do that.
Oh, I think he's just much smarter than me. Yeah.
More experience.
Yeah.
That's fair. Let's see. Other questions here. Some on certificates. So going back to this idea of like taking courses for certificates versus taking courses in college, do you have recommendations one way or another? Or how should somebody decide between course at a college, course for a certificate, things like that?
I mean, part of the decision nowadays is probably cost, frankly. And if by certificate you're alluding to like freely available courses like CS50s or others on edX, Coursera, and the like, then there's a lot of like high quality free educational content out there nowadays. And that's wonderful. I think the catch for a lot of people, and probably people like me, is that without having some skin in the game, so to speak, without actually paying some tuition, I frankly am probably less likely to finish the thing that I started. So there's something to be said for having some sort of commitment, even if it's financially or maybe it's socially, like taking a class, be it free or paid, with a friend. Much like my jogs with Kareem, part of that was motivated by I'm not going to embarrass myself by in front of Kareem by not going jogging with him. So I would go, and maybe he was kind of doing the same, so it sort of was a win-win. But with that said, I think what you're also paying for frequently, even at places like Harvard Online, through Harvard Extension School and the like, you're paying for support. You're paying for like human time and access to people who presumably are more learned at that point than you in some subject, who are hopefully good teachers, who can therefore hopefully help you navigate what is, yes, freely available out there on Google, Wikipedia, ChatGPT, but can deliver it in a way that is maybe optimal for you, more so than the internet alone can do. So I think it kind of depends on like what opportunities you have in front of you, who it is that's teaching these classes. But I certainly don't think you have to pay for something if you want the knowledge, even though we certainly still live in a world where traditional credentials, degrees, and so forth still do open doors.
Yeah, they do. And I think if you're going to take that step and pay the money to take a course, like I'd try to make sure you're able to put in the time to talk with people in the class, to ask questions of the professor or the teacher, just to make sure you're getting all you can out of it from that human time that's involved with the course as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And happy to field any questions too, or ask them of you if you'd
yeah,
like.
Yeah, sure. If you want, you can scroll through here a little bit. I think we're getting towards the bottom of our questions here, but I think one other one is, have we considered using examples to ease new programmers by letting them know that you won't ever be a master at programming and forget basic things all the time?
Can you ask that once more?
Yeah. Have we considered using examples to ease new programmers in by letting them know you won't ever be a master at programming?
Oh, well, hopefully that came across in my comments earlier that even after 25 years, I feel like I'm a better programmer this year than I was last year. So I do think it's like an evolving process. And that's not only because I'm seeing other examples of code, I'm sort of learning different design techniques or paradigms over that many years too. Like the world is changing, like the languages, the technologies, the libraries are changing, people's methodologies and design patterns, as they tend to be called, are evolving. So there's just like better ways to do things nowadays than there were 25 years ago. So there's always like new runway in front of you. So I would just kind of embrace it. Like what we tell our teaching assistants here on campus when we're training them at the beginning of the term is to get comfortable being uncomfortable. Like, because as soon as you're comfortable, you presumably kind of maxed out what it is you're going to get out of the experience. So the fact that even I still get nervous, like getting up on stage and in front of CS50 and hoping that no one asks a question that's really beyond me, I think is good because it motivates me to keep learning and it keeps it fun and interesting.
Yeah, and I think this reminds me, we just talked to some of our friends in Nicaragua who are teaching CS50X there, and they had the same question of their students often feel like they aren't smart enough or aren't able to put in the time to like understand the concepts. And I think what we advise is just, you know, setting the expectation, like this is gonna be hard, it's gonna be require you to ask a lot of questions, and you're gonna wanna put in the time for it just to understand it.
Yeah, you know? So true, yeah. So true.
A few more questions here.
Yeah, here I have a question from David M, who's curious to understand from Carter what your process was like for creating a new class like CS50 SQL. So it's not just one that already existed that you were modifying or iterating on, like you literally had to start from scratch. So what was your process for doing that?
Yeah, so there's this idea of like backwards design, designing a course. And I like this idea because you tend to start at the end, which is where do you want students to be when they finish that course? Mm-hmm. I think for us, that was, we want students to have this basic understanding of SQL, to be able to make their own databases, to be able to go off and manage databases if they'd like, and also to kind of see how it's relevant to their own daily lives and their own real world. So that was like our goal for students. I think for me, it was this process of how do I first figure out the content I need to teach in the lecture, like what should be included every week so you actually get that stepping stone towards that ultimate goal. And then the question became, once I've kind of shared this content, what are the kinds of problems that are engaging that kind of test you on that content and give the actual skills to practice what we taught in lecture.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of designing your own course, whether it's several weeks or even just one class, that's hopefully perhaps some helpful advice too.
Yeah.
Let's see, there's a question here that popped up about AI, which we've been asked before, but maybe you can offer your perspective.
Sure.
How do you feel about the threat of AI to the software engineering field?
To the software engineering field.
So this is the sort of dark side of the question with which we began today.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. In terms of a threat, I see more of the threats along trying to have AI make too many decisions for us a little too quickly and relying on a little too much at the very beginning. Like I think it's worth taking some time to figure out what AI does particularly well and what it doesn't do very well and trying to put in some safeguards so we don't go too off the rails too quickly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah. And if I can maybe extrapolate from this question, I do think we've seen a lot of questions from folks online about should they even bother learning programming now if like AI is going to be writing more code?
Yeah, I think you absolutely should. Like, it's still worth understanding these first principles that have helped build things like AI. And I think if we have more people who are more well-versed in those principles, we're better off able to make AI that helps us in the long term. Yeah.
So. We have a question for Carter, too, about CS50 SQL. How do you shorten the full 2+ hour long CS50 SQL lecture down to an hour on the section tab on the CS50 website? I think we might be conflating two types of material here, perhaps.
Yeah, I think what you might be talking about might be the sections we've been doing this semester.
Yes, and maybe compressing the material, not the videos themselves.
Exactly. So if you've been tuning in live this semester, we've been having our live lectures in Sanders Theater with David, followed by sections led by me in our own CS50 office. I think the question is asking, how do we condense this full 2.5 hour lecture down to like a section video, which is only like an hour long?
Yeah.
And I think for me, the question is, starting again from like, what do I want you to learn? Ultimately, I want you to learn how to do the problem set well and independently. And so I kind of pick and choose pieces of content that will help you do that best and hopefully give you some exercises to kind of practice that on your own with a group and section and then go off independently and focus on the problem set afterwards.
Okay, yeah. Fair. Question here from Sandesh. I get your point, although which free resources would you recommend beyond CS50?
Beyond CS50? Just speaking personally, I found a few others helpful. I found some of our friends at like Free Code Camp, like they have really good resources.
Yeah, we're friends with those folks. Yeah.
Yeah, so they have really good ones on web development, all kinds of other languages. So I'd really encourage you to check out Free Code Camp as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And a question from Mark. How do you know you're ready for the workspace? I know I'm improving and growing, but I just can't get myself to start applying to jobs.
Yeah, that's something I felt. I think maybe acknowledging you might never quite feel ready. And the way you get ready is by just kind of doing it, right? Just submitting that application, just like sending your name out there and saying, I want to do this and I'll learn what I need to learn to be able to do it as well.
Yeah, so. And if it helps Mark, go get a job.
Yeah.
Like CS50 is telling you it is time to leave the nest and go pursue a job. And in all seriousness too, even if you ultimately find that you're not quite ready for jobs for which you're finding interviews, mm-hmm. like the experience and the practice of going through those motions of interviewing with folks, getting a sense of the questions that they ask, getting a sense of how you conduct yourself, what you can do better, is honestly invaluable too. So I think it's actually better to probably start the process even before you feel you're ready, because that process will only make you feel more ready. And heck, best outcome could be that you find an opportunity that is actually a good fit along the way, and boom, you tripped yourself into finding that job sooner rather than later.
Exactly.
It doesn't seem like there's any downside to starting now. So that's Mark's homework.
The worst you'll hear is no, and then you try again.
How about time for a couple more questions before we wrap? So we have a question here. What should a student do after completing the CS50 course in cybersecurity? Mm. Which, mind you, is not completable yet because we're posting it every couple of weeks.
So I'd probably make sure you do the rest of the course if you think you've completed it right now. But after that, I would say maybe think about how you want to apply that knowledge. For me, it was very interesting to just learn more about the first principles of cybersecurity and think about how I could better understand things like safety and AI, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I think just trying to ask yourself that question of like, what do you want to learn now that you've understood all that is part of CS50 cybersecurity?
Nice. Yeah. Maybe a final question about the road ahead for folks. Bernardo asks, is it greedy to try learning many different concepts or technologies, even if you feel like doing it?
Certainly not greedy. I think the good thing about knowledge is that it's available to everyone, and you taking it doesn't diminish it from everyone else.
That's very well said.
Yeah, I think one thing I'd caution, though, is trying to take on too much at one time. Like, I think I've kind of fallen in the habit of wanting to learn 5 different things, and only focusing on each of them a little bit and not focusing on one or two like with all my attention. And so I'd probably say it's better to choose at the very beginning like maybe 2 or 3 things you want to learn and make sure you can spend the time actually learning those and all the
Really well said. Well, thank you so much to our friends Vlad and Max, who are here behind the camera helping us film this. This will indeed be posted on demand thereafter if you joined us late but would like to catch up on some of the questions that classmates and others asked. Any final words from you? Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in and hope to see you next time.
Indeed, likewise. And I think if we were a TV show, what we would do is end by Carter and I running off playfully to go play some more volleyball. So should we do that and run off camera?
All right.
All right. See you later.